Now that heart is beating fast, and that's the rhythm I can dance to. Well, I'm mighty glad I've got a chance to. That one big heart that's beating fast. Tomorrow morning, let it rain. Tomorrow morning, let it pour. Tonight, we're in the groove together. Ain't gonna worry about stormy weather. Gonna kick old trouble out the door. Beat out old trouble on the drum. Beat out old trouble on the drum. Beat out old trouble on the drum. And kick old trouble out the door. Beat me that rhythm on the drum. And kick old trouble out the door. Kick him 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 out the door.
Welcome to Radical Australian Community Radio 3CR. Henrietta, the producer, is with us, but she refuses to talk. And those of you who told me that Henrietta is a hen, that's the hens from Sunshine, that's incorrect. Henrietta is a human being who is embarrassed to be the producer for Radical Australia. She's trying to get me to introduce the guest, which we will in a second, when you know how bad I am with names, listeners. Now, we have Shelley Van Der Woof.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
That's correct.
I can't believe it. I got something right for a change.
Good job.
You look a bit flustered.
I've just been walking.
No, but you look a bit worn out. What's going on in your life?
Oh, okay. That's because I haven't caught my sleep up because I got off a plane 5 a.m. yesterday.
You got off a plane?
Mm-hmm.
Where have you been? To the moon or something? Or even worse?
No, I haven't been to the moon. I went to a lovely place.
Right.
We call it West Papua. They call it... Or Papua, often Australians say,
but
the locals call it Papua.
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 What happened to Irian Jaya? I don't use that anymore.
When I was at primary school, that's what I learnt the name was.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, we'll talk about that later on.
Sure.
I mean, not a lot of people go to West Papua.
No, it's
a pretty hard journey, although it's only 70 kilometres from Australia up north.
I know.
How many planes did you have to catch?
Three.
Three. Three.
Yeah, I started Monday morning at 10:30 and I got home at 5 a.m. yesterday. It was a long trip.
Three planes.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously a few hundred bucks.
Mm-hmm. Same price as a ticket to London and back.
It makes it difficult, doesn't it? We'll talk about that later on.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to ask you something I shouldn't ask you, but you know, it's that type. I'm that type of person. What year were you born?
1964.
64. So you're relatively... Henrietta was also born in 64. Those, if there's no television,
she's celebrating. Thumbs up.
She's celebrating. She's one of your type. Same cultural immersion.
Mm-hmm.
Where were you born?
Box Hill.
A Box Hill.
Literally, the hospital.
but that's not an Aussie name.
No.
Was that acquired by marriage or
it
by
was.
Birth?
I came from English and Scottish stock. £10 poms.
£10 poms.
Paid to come here.
Yeah.
And then I married.
Did they go to Bougainvillea, whatever it is?
No.
£10 poms.
Yeah.
Are your parents still alive?
Yes, both of them.
So we've got to say nice things about them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Are they good parents?
Yeah, they are good parents.
And what type of, what are their names?
Alan and Jeanette.
Alan and Jeanette.
Mm-hmm.
And they're happy they came to Australia as £10 poms or
they got
regrets?
No regrets. They got their citizenship 2 years ago. Because you could hold dual citizenship.
Well, you can.
They relinquished it well and truly a couple of years ago.
Yeah, but the great thing about being a £10 bomb, if you came before, I think it was 1986, before the Hawke government came in, you could vote in Australian elections. And I know £10 bombs who've refused to take out citizenship who can still vote in Australian elections. You like that? So we're waiting for them to die out.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So what was life in Box Hill like for a young person, a young little kiddie like you? Were you running around barefooted with your siblings?
So my parents moved pretty quickly to Adelaide.
Oh, they saw the light.
And set up shop there. My father worked for what was then the PNG.
Oh, yes, Postmaster General.
Then it was Telecom. Then it was Telstra.
Yep. And then it was privatised, then became Telstra.
And then it was privatised. Yep. And so I spent most of my formative years at the outskirts of Adelaide.
That doesn't sound nice.
Well, look, it's as a child, you don't really know what's nice and what's not. There's food on the table. We had a pet.
What was the pet?
It was a Great Dane.
A Great Dane.
Yeah, we thought it was a horse. But you can't ride dogs because we gave her a back injury.
Did you? A Great Dane.
But she didn't come with us when we...
The only good thing about Great Danes is they make good, solid feces. They're not runny.
Okay, that's a fun fact I didn't know.
Well, you would have known. You had a Great Dane. Didn't you have to clean up as a child?
No, not the dog's poop.
That wasn't your job. Did you have brothers to do that?
I had two younger brothers.
That was their job, I
don't know.
Your great...
No recollections of dog's poop.
No recollections. So where did you go to school?
I went to Salisbury North Primary School.
I can't believe this. I went to Salisbury High School.
Yeah.
But it wasn't in Adelaide, it was in Brisbane.
Yeah, okay. It was kind of on the outskirts of, wasn't even connected to Adelaide at that stage.
Salisbury North High School, primary school.
Yeah.
Do you have any recollections?
I was only mild recollections. I remember being the hall monitor for ringing the bell.
That's a very, very prestigious position as a primary school child.
It was, because I was only there until grade three.
What, did you get expelled?
No, we migrated to Victoria. But I don't have a lot of recollections because I was quite unwell as a child.
Can I ask what was wrong?
Yeah, I had a disease that tried to kill me and it knocked out part of my kidneys.
Did you have glomerulonephritis?
Yeah, I did.
So did I.
Well, surprise.
So did I.
Oh.
Yeah, I had mine in the mid-50s. No, late 50s, because it was a virus.
Yeah, it was.
Which you'd catch glomerulonephritis, and it would cause kidney failure.
Yeah.
And in those days, there was no dialysis.
No.
And they'd put you in a corner to die, basically, with a low-salt diet. Did you get the scrambled eggs I used to have to deal with every day for 9 months in hospital?
No, I think the main course of treatment, I was in the 1970 cohort.
Ah.
And they labelled the groups of children that they treated cohorts. Okay. And basically they bombarded our system with cortisone.
Yep.
And I learnt from my kidney specialist when I was older that I was lucky to have children.
Do you still have residual kidney problems?
Only if I push my system too much, like not really, only when I was pregnant and I just monitor things.
What's your GFR?
Oh, and that I can't tell you.
You can't tell me?
No.
Because, you know, when it gets too low, we're looking at dialysis.
Yeah, no, I'm
you're
fortunate enough.
That's
I was lucky enough. They caught it early.
Yeah, look, I've never interviewed somebody who had glomerulonephritis as a child. I think we're going to bond really well during the next 50 minutes.
It just meant that I spent grade two watching Elvis movies because I was at home.
Yeah. Did you have the big belly and the, you know, and because you were quite severe?
Well, as a child, the main side effects I remember was having a lot of kidney pain.
Yep.
And because cortisone is such a lethal medication, it causes a lot of water retention. Mm. So my parents told me I got teased a lot and called moon face.
You're a cherub. You're an 18th century cherub. Okay. This type you see in paintings.
Okay.
You weren't moon face.
Right, there you go.
You've got to look at the positive.
I'll reclaim that name.
Reclaim that.
Yeah. But it taught me, my parents didn't have a lot of money, but they looked after me really well, which is, it taught me how important it was to have a carer that really loves you because it would make the pain go away.
Yeah.
And it taught me resilience around pain, because as a child you don't know that you're in pain compared to other kids. And it taught me that I was lucky, because when I went into hospital I'd meet kids that were, because I spent a lot of time in the Royal Children's Hospital getting biopsied and checked. And
was this in Adelaide or here?
There and then here.
Right.
And when we moved back when I was in grade three. And I saw kids that were, I was really jealous because they all got to go to school in the hospital.
Mm.
And I know in hindsight I was lucky because I was only there for like a week and a half.
Yeah.
And
Well, I spent almost a year of my life in hospital.
But in the
50s, mid-50s, late-50s, there was no treatment.
Yeah.
So there was no treatment. We weren't put on cortisone. There was nothing.
Mm-hmm.
They just put you in a corner and fed you a low-salt diet and crossed their fingers that you'd get better.
Yeah.
So in many ways you were fortunate
I think you didn't spend all that.
Yeah. Those poor kiddies who were going to school, they would have had incipient failure or they would have been on early dialysis or something.
Lots of reasons they were in hospital.
Anybody else in the family caught it or was it just
No, it was just me.
Were you living near a creek or anything like that in Adelaide?
We've never really had discussions over how I acquired it.
It's a virus. So.
Yeah. So we've never really...
Yeah.
I mean, the only other time we've talked about it is I've got mild and ear hearing loss in one ear and moderate in the other ear, which is kind of annoying when you're a musician. But we thought that was linked to getting an enormous dose of cortisone in my system, and it knocked out my hearing a bit.
Did you get gentamicin as an antibiotic? Because that causes hearing. It's a recognised complication of gentamicin.
Yeah,
and these days when you use it, which is rarely. When you do levels to make sure you've got the correct levels.
Really?
So most likely you may have had a course of gentamicin, and that's what's caused the hearing loss as a child.
This is why we're having this interview. I'm learning things I didn't know.
Yeah, and I'm not going to even send you a bill. Think about it, how lucky you are. You're learning these things.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
No, I'm just besotted with you that you had glomerulonephritis like I did as a child.
Surprise.
I mean, what a bonding experience.
Yeah, I haven't met anyone else.
No, well, you've met somebody here.
Yeah.
I mean, when you talk about glomerulonephritis, they just look at you. I'm going overseas in a few days and I had to pay $350 extra on my medical insurance because I've still got some residual issues with my kidneys due to the glomerulonephritis almost 70 years ago. That's extraordinary when you think about it.
Yeah.
But that's a different story. Now, so you finished primary school here in Melbourne.
Correct.
And by the time you finished, you were well?
Yeah. Only going in for, I can't remember when they stopped, where they would biopsy.
Mm-hmm.
They'd stick me alive. When I say alive, as in awake.
Yeah.
And they'd stick a needle in me and pull out a bit of my kidney and have
a look
at it.
Yeah, it's
really. And I feel like I was monitored by the Children's Hospital till I was 18. I
wouldn't be surprised. Yeah.
And then, and then kind of didn't really have any ongoing issues until when I was pregnant with my kids. I just had to monitor things.
So what high school did you go to in Melbourne?
So my brothers went to the local high school and my parents sent me off to MLC, which is a private girls' school in Kew.
I cannot believe how many people we interview on this program that went to Methodist Ladies College. Let's get it right.
Methodist Ladies College. It's not Methodist anymore, but it certainly is.
Isn't it?
Still ladies. It's called MLC, but
it's not owned by them. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, when they amalgamated.
But there's still those Methodists who kind of didn't join the United Church, aren't there, out there?
It was a big school. That's why so many people still going strong.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. A lot of taxpayers' money goes into it. And I'm proud to see you're the product of that.
And my parents' fees. They worked really hard to keep me at school.
Well, that's what they all say. Now,
they did.
Henrietta, you didn't go to MLC. Oh, no, she's just shook her head. Whew. I thought I was going to be attacked here. So it wasn't co-ed then, was it?
Oh, no.
No.
And it's not. Still,
No.
So my parents decided that it was important for me to get a great education. I came from a family of my father was an engineer and my two brothers were maths geniuses. I wasn't so much a maths genius, but they decided they would like me to get a good education. And I feel really thankful because between that and Girl Guides, I just grew up through young adulthood thinking that not feeling oppressed. Not feeling like gender equality. I thought everything was equal because of those experiences.
Because
I played cricket.
Because you didn't interact with blokes and boys.
Well, because I didn't.
Yeah.
Or if I did, it was in a setting where say, when I was a young person, 14 to 18 year old, and they call them ranger guides.
Yep.
You know, you had an all female group. And if we had to go camping, we'd be organising everything, not driving.
Yep.
And so when we'd arrive at any joint activities with the scouts that have girls and boys now, we wouldn't be sitting back and waiting to lead ourselves. We'd just be stepping into the leadership space.
Well, that was your job between four. When did you join the Girl Guides?
My parents joined me when I was 8 in Adelaide. I was a brownie.
A brownie.
In the days when brownies existed.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, I remember brownies. Now, you're not Roman Catholic, are you?
No.
No, thank God for that. No. You know why I say that?
No, I don't.
Because brownies is another term for a scapular.
Right.
Which is a little brown piece of cloth we used to wear. Yeah, and if we had that around our neck when we got run over by a bus, we go straight to heaven because we couldn't be in sin. Okay. So there's two meanings.
There you go. Well, now they're just called guides.
Now, I need to know this because I've always wanted to ask a girl guide or a boy scout. Because my father forbid me to join the boy scouts. He thought it was too militaristic.
Well, certainly Robert Baden Powell set it up like the military system because of his experience in Kenya and he recruited young people. So it certainly has that style of you vote in a leader, as in the girls in each small group and the boys vote who gets to be the leader and who gets to be the second assistant. But in terms of military, the only other lookalikes would be the uniform, which I actually quite like uniform because it equalises everybody, rich or poor.
Did you have the little tie?
Yeah, I was from
and a little hat?
Oh, yeah, the beret.
The beret. You had a beret.
And I was a...
Very militaristic.
A youth leader right up to 26.
Up to 26?
Yeah, a youth member.
Does that mean you could tie knots?
Yeah, don't ask me now, but I did get a few badges.
How many badges did you get?
I don't remember.
30, 40?
Don't remember.
A youth leader, 26? Come on.
I'm a bit of a scoundrel because...
What, you didn't like...
Well, I like all the guidelines and the rules, but... When I was Assistant State Commissioner for Girl Guides, which was in 2005, I'd mischievously, because there was three of us to the State Commissioner, I mischievously mixed my badges up. All the young women that I had a connection with would come up and adjust my badges
and laugh because
they knew I was being naughty.
I've heard of being naughty. I wouldn't describe that as naughty. I'd describe that as being mischievous.
Mischievous, I was being mischievous.
Yes, you were being mischievous, Yeah, there's a Shakespearean quote about that, but I've forgotten. Was it born to be mischief?
Yeah. And I think, I'm very thankful for my experience in Girl Guides because it teaches you self-leadership as well, strengthens your values and who you are, and 10% of girls and young women in the world don't have a strong leader, and I mean could be a parent or could be a teacher. In their lives, and the strongest growth in Girl Guides or Girl Scouts is in Africa and Asia.
Are you still involved?
Not so much. I'm connected to some Trefoil guilds, which are when you're kind of retired.
Oh, is this like the RSL for Girl Guides?
Yeah, when you're retired, you still believe in the principles and you still fundraise.
So what are the principles?
They're a set of values which would be recognisable in the West that you have to adhere to, and it encompasses freedom of speech and not discriminating against others. And you make a commitment to yourself and other elements, and that's why some countries can't be members of the Worldwide Association of Girl Guides and Girl Scouts because they can't adhere to the principles that guide it.
Right.
Yeah, so... that's changed since changes in Russia and some countries have come back on board. But, it's a great organisation.
Now, I understand you said your brothers were math geniuses.
Yeah.
Did you excel at anything in high school?
I loved sciences, but I wasn't that great at it. But I ended up going in and doing a Bachelor of Applied Science. So I must have been...
So you did get HSC?
Yeah, I did HSC. And
do you remember what year that was?
1981.
Right. Did they have those marks then, or you just got your VCE, or they have all those?
Yeah, no, you got marked per subject.
Right.
And then
aggregate mark.
Aggregate mark.
And what was your aggregate mark?
Oh, man.
Come on.
The math genius doesn't hold the numbers in her head.
Doesn't.
So I got a B, overall B.
All right.
So, you know, coming out of a large school, I thought I was a pretty average student, but it turned out I wasn't.
Right. So what average. University did you go to?
I ended up going to, it's changed its name now, yep. but it was Lincoln School of Health Science.
Right.
And La Trobe University in my final year took it over because they picked up all the social, we wanted to align with the social sciences, whereas physiotherapy went to Melbourne Uni and all the other therapies, podiatry and speech pathology and allied health all went to La Trobe University.
So what was your bachelor in?
So I did a Bachelor of Applied Science in Occupational Therapy.
And did you do a master's?
Or? No, in those days it wasn't really open to us.
Yeah.
Now you have to do a master's as part of you, in addition. So, it's a master's of occupational therapy.
So that means you graduated as an occupational therapist?
Correct.
So what was your first job?
My first job was in a school.
A school? Why would you have an occupational therapist in a school?
It was in the very, very early days. It was a tech school
when
tech schools existed. And it was in the really early days of the education department funding, providing extra funding to schools to support students that were having learning challenges. So I worked with kids who had disabilities or concentration problems or handwriting problems or difficulty organising themselves in the classroom.
So you actually assigned to a specific school?
Yeah, in the days under that system, I had a six-month contract with them.
Right.
Mm, and then the system changed a little bit and became more centralised.
Yeah. And did you continue being an occupational therapist?
Yeah, I haven't stopped since.
You haven't stopped?
No, 39 years.
Now, a lot of people, look, I hate to be rude. Look, I do understand what you do, but a lot of people who are maybe listening into this have got no idea. Because, you know, the old theory was that occupational therapists taught people to weave baskets.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And I did do basket weaving.
You did do basket weaving.
They don't do it anymore. But no. So Florence Nightingale was really the person that spurred on this notion of changing your life for the better, either physically, mentally or emotionally or spiritually, by engaging in occupation because she... During, which war was it? The Crimean War.
Yep.
She gave them activity to do which would help them to recover.
Mm.
So OTs, depending on what setting you meet them in, like if you met me in a hospital, my chief responsibility would be before the person was discharged home, are they able to complete their activities of daily living, using the bathroom, cooking, all those basic ones. But often it's always got the occupations, but that includes work. So I've worked in the workplace. At the moment I work in community health with people with chronic pain.
Mm-hmm.
So it often depends on the setting, what kind of you lean into, but we like looking at the whole person. And I specialised in working with kids for a while and the activities that are important to them are home-related things and school-related things. And then, of course, as you become a worker, it's work-related things and home-related things.
Now, you're working now currently with people with chronic referred pain.
Chronic and persistent pain, yes.
Yeah. So what role would an occupational therapist play in that regarding therapy?
Yeah, so in my team I work for Whole Step Health, which is a community health service that supports the kind of northern metropolitan area, Marybeck Council, Hume Council, but we also cover the old area that used to be Banyul Community Health because we amalgamated Mary Health, amalgamated with Banyul Community Health last year and became Whole Step Health. And so we've got some commonalities in our role. We have a pain physiotherapist, another physio, a psychologist, a care coordinator who's a nurse.
So you're part of a team.
Part of a team. So we have similar approaches, but we all come at it from a different angle. So I'm looking at, and how are you managing those things that you have to do in your life, including your hobbies? What becomes really important when you've had lots of things taken out of your life because of pain, including work, family. Mm. What's important is left is what you do with your time and what brings you joy.
Well, that's right. There's a lot of new theories regarding pain, especially chronic pain.
Yeah.
It's not something you can give a pill to to resolve. All you do in many cases just cause addiction.
Yeah, our program is a smaller program, but it's following the new, I guess you could say, new generation of pain science, and it has amazing results because it's mind-body, and we approach it that way rather than just through the body, which was my old learning. Golly, being an OT over 39 years, you see the signs just change. And emotional well-being is an integral part of it.
Yeah, look, I've got a motto. I've just thought of a motto for occupational therapists.
Right, go for it.
Idle hands do the devil's work. I'm sure that's where Florence Nightingale was coming from.
Well, perhaps
that was
the
big 19th century concept.
Mm-hmm.
Idle hands do the devil's work.
Mm-hmm.
Keep them occupied.
With things that bring
no
them,
criticism.
With things that bring them joy.
Yeah. Things that bring them joy.
Things that bring them joy.
Yeah, like weaving baskets.
Well, yeah, I failed basket weaving.
You failed basket weaving?
Yeah.
We'll have to send you up to Arnhem Land. They'll teach you how to weave good baskets.
Yeah.
And at Lake Tyers here, some of the Aboriginal women who lived there. It was a very famous Aboriginal woman. There's a photograph of her in the National Gallery of Victoria. It's just titled The Basket Weaver. Extraordinary work. But that's a different story. Is it fulfilling work being an occupational therapist? Because it's not as if you go in and you put in a new heart valve and people jump off the table and run around. I mean, it's very tedious work, isn't it?
Oh, no, I love it. I love it because the word I often use is complexity, which is people are complex anyway, but often with chronic health problems, you can't just march in and do something to somebody, which is kind of the medical model, and people give up their authority and they hand it over to the medical profession. And occupational therapists, along with a lot of allied health workers, including doctors and nurses nowadays, don't work that way. They work collaboratively, where the power... There's not this power differentiation. When our clients come in, they've sometimes had awful experiences with interacting with the health sector that doesn't believe them because they turn up to emergency departments with chronic pain and people are telling them it's all in their head. And so they come in quite cautious and nervous. And I just set it up very carefully so that they know that I'm not the boss, that this is a shared partnership and they help drive it. And then they take back some of that power that's been taken away from them by their experiences of chronic illness. And little by little, their inside, their self-efficacy, their willingness to take power and control increases, and so does their health.
When did you read that? It sounds like you believe that.
That's the essence of OT.
Yeah, you believe it, obviously.
Absolutely. I've seen it happen. You can just see someone, I'm thinking... without any doubt and value, everything.
Right.
Just someone making a simple statement like, oh, I went away on my own and looked after myself and I went jogging. And all these simple things we take for granted, and you can see the pride and the joy it's bringing them, and little by little they pull back bits of their health towards themselves, and it makes you cry.
It's what people forget. I mean, I deal with people with chronic physical disabilities for over almost 50 years. But the thing is, what people forget is what we take for granted. We jump out of bed, have a shower, you know, wipe our bum, whatever.
Well, I'll get
dressed.
I'll give you take for granted, and this is a little bit of my hobby horse. So I got on the tram at Nicholson Street to come here because I live in the Brunswick area. And I'll tell you why I was watching the tram stop. There was three women with babies in prams, one pregnant, and a low-level tram, and they easily got in. And I thought, if we were on the number 19 tram, because I'm on the Sydney Roads Accessible Tram Stop activist group, community group, these women would not be able to get on so easily, and the lady who was pregnant would find it really hard. And then I'm coming down Nicholson Street going, every tram stop is accessible and every tram is low-level. How come we can't have it? So that's the campaign I'm involved in. We've got no money, but we've got...
Well, that's for Sydney
Roads. Bunch of Sydney Roads accessible tram stop. Google us.
Get rid of the parking and you can have an accessible tram stop.
Well, we're not asking for much. We just want some. We just want the government to say what they do by December 22. We're a thorn in the side of the government. They know we're there.
No, you're a burr under the saddle. You're riding them. You're a burr under the saddle. You're not a fool on the side.
Thank you. I think we are a burr in the
saddle. Because you're in the saddle. right?
Yeah, yeah.
On top of them.
And one of our local Member of Parliament said, just keep at it. It's working.
It's working, yeah.
Yeah, we haven't made any change yet, but we're making a lot of noise.
You've got to embarrass them. Look, I'm going to give young Shelley a rest for a second. We're going to do a community announcement. This is Radical Australian Community Radio 3CR. Henrietta, the invisible person, is doing all the work. She's just ashamed of us. She said, we'll help you as long as you don't mention our name. And see, she won't even talk on the microphone. I just can't believe it. I mean, I'm being reduced to this, having an invisible producer. And we're chatting, not interviewing, chatting with Shelley van der Werf regarding her life. And we've smelt a little bit of radicalism in terms of her career in the Girl Guides, her career as an occupational therapist, and now she's the burr under the saddle of a community group.
Of the burrs. I'm a collective of burrs.
You're a collective of burrs. Well,
yeah.
Well, tell us a few of these burrs that you're interested in. First of all, are you religiously inclined?
I am. I'm a Christian.
You're a Christian. Any particular denomination, can I ask?
No, not really. Mm. Just one that I go to an all-inclusive church in Brunswick. You can come as you are. You can be any version of any gender or neurodiverse. You can be anything and you're safe. Not all churches are like that, but this one is.
Do you sing at the church?
I do, and play the guitar.
You sing, you play guitar. Didn't I see you before? Did I see you on the 17th of December with those crazy people from the climate choir?
Oh, yeah.
Were you one of them?
Radical activists, all us grey-haired people in the climate choir.
Are you,
yes,
you one of them?
I am. I play the guitar with someone you know, Nancy.
Nancy?
Nancy.
I don't know anybody called Nancy. Never heard of her. Never heard of her.
Yeah, she plays the accordion and I play with her, and Jenny Marsh is the leader, and it's my version of activism. I like the quiet, gentle, just be a little burr under the saddle, or in the case of people that aren't interested in climate issues, just to gently bring the issues. And we became a overnight Instagram hit during the election. You have to get 100,000 likes
Instagram
on Instagram.
Sensation.
Yeah.
Because
we sung a song. And it got 100,000 likes 3 days before the election in 3 days. We thought it was hysterical. We got onto YouTube and Facebook and Instagram decided to be.
And nobody remembers. That's the beauty about it, not going viral.
No.
24 hours later, nobody remembers.
But we did the trick. We went to all the marginal seats where we thought climate was important.
Did you?
And we just sung to the queues of people getting ready to vote. And sometimes people would yell at us. And we'd just keep singing because it's really hard for people to yell at you when you're singing.
Well, it is, unless they've got a gun. Now, guitar.
Mm.
Is this a hangover from a kid or is this something you've acquired lately?
Later as an adult.
Later as an adult.
Yeah, I used to sing.
Mm-hmm.
I've sung all my life. My main instruments.
What do you mean you used to sing? What? MLC? Church?
Yeah,
Girl
that's
Guides?
Choral singing, man. We had house competitions.
Excuse me?
Yeah, you're in
Girl Guides have?
No. Well, Girl Guides did have a singing thing that I went to in Tasmania, but Girl Guides sing all the time.
Right.
Yeah, we've got songbooks.
Just the joy of life.
Yeah, songs from around the world.
Manly, is that what your house at MLC?
No, I was in Fitchett.
You were in what?
Yeah, that was named after one of the original people at the school.
You didn't sing at MLC?
In chorals, not chorals. That's in group singing.
Right.
And then in my 40s, I mean, I did singing lessons, and then in my 40s I started going to a music camp.
A music camp.
Yeah, called Summer Song.
Is that like a boot camp for musicians?
Yeah, for a week.
What do you do?
This one's been going for 30 years. I think it's in hiatus this year and next year maybe.
Right.
And people go up and you kind of, it's just about a small group of like 100, which means you get to know people. And that's how a lot of my friends that I'm connected with I met through this camp. I'm going on a songwriting retreat in Vietnam next month and it's all connected through this camp. So you go up there and you sing along, you go to classes, And Tony Backhouse is one of the founders, and he runs choirs. And then one day I decided I need to start learning guitar so that I can songwrite, because it's hard to write songs if you don't have an instrument.
Really?
Yeah.
I wouldn't know.
Hmm.
Oh, I've learned something. So, you need an instrument to songwrite.
Well, it makes it easier. I've got lots of friends that don't play an instrument and songwrite.
But their songs are terrible compared to yours.
No.
Of course. All right, now, Birds Under the Saddle.
Yep.
Climate Choir.
Mm.
I'm interested. You did mention at the beginning of this chat that you had to worry about your kidneys when you were pregnant. So that means you've got kids, have you?
Yeah, I've got two.
Two. And obviously they look after themselves these days, don't
they? Yeah, I have. I've one of my children needs a bit more support than other people.
Right.
Which is the reason we moved to Brunswick, because we secured social housing through a housing organisation called Nightingale Housing.
Yep.
Which is the reason we moved, and I've never lived in an apartment in my life, but it turns out it's okay. And it's in Brunswick, which is really exciting.
Well, as long as you've got a roof over your head, it's okay.
Yeah.
And as long as you've got stability and security.
Yeah, which is why we moved, because social housing, the funding's similar to public housing, just slightly different structure. And
the different structure is social housing is private housing. State-owned.
It's not state-owned. I know. It's complexity. So,
There's no complexity. It's been made complex. It's very simple. Public housing, state-owned, state-managed. Social housing, affordable housing, whatever you like to call it, is privately owned. Could be a charity group. Could be. For money, who knows? But we won't talk about that. Well, that's good that you were able to stabilise your son. That's good, because housing is critical in those situations.
Fundamental when you don't have much income.
And the thing is, you know, as we get older, you worry about your children, what's going to happen to them, especially if they're in a position where they can't do everything for themselves. So, and having secure housing is everything.
It's basic human need, Maslow's hierarchy.
So I'm a bit confused. You're working as an OT. You've got two sons that you've...
No, I don't. I have a son and a daughter.
Oh, sorry, my apologies. Yeah. A son and a daughter, right, which, you know, there's a lot of work goes into that. Do you have a husband or a partner? I know it's none of my business, but some people do and some don't.
I've been married for 39 years.
Oh, well, that makes it a lot easier.
Yeah, and I'm lucky because we're in a position where I can do a lot of... I support two family members who are NDIS, National Disability Insurance Scheme participants, and it takes. It's a wonderful scheme, and Urella, the organisation that I used to work for 10 years, it was our chairman of the board that started the whole ball rolling with the Big Ideas conference with Kevin Rudd in those days. But it's like anyone that uses a system that government owns, like Centrelink, if you need an advocate who can support you to navigate the system, so I do that. So,
are you the advocate?
Yes, I'm the primary carer for two people. So as a result,
That's a lot of tedious work.
You have to be vigilant and persistent. And if you're not able to advocate for yourself, it's pretty tricky. So I don't work full time.
No.
Which is why I can do these other things.
Right.
Because I've got stable income, someone that.
And you'd have super.
Correct. I'm one of the women's generation that has super.
Which is unusual.
Yeah.
It's a very unfair system. But
especially for women older than me.
Who didn't
have super.
Well, even those now, it's still very unfair.
Mm-hmm.
If you got low wages, you get low super. Mm-hmm. If you've got high wages, it's highway to heaven.
Mm-hmm.
So, Girl Guides, NDIS, Climate Choir.
Susan Rose Accessible Transpops. Yeah, we call it SATS for short.
Anything else? I mean, it's as if you've got nothing to do.
I've only got one other kind of volunteer role.
What's that?
And because I'm trying to take it a bit easier this year, but we'll see how that goes. I'm a volunteer facilitator for a program called the Alternatives to Violence Project.
What's it called again?
Alternatives to Violence Project.
Right. And is that a private organisation or state government or federal government? What?
No, it's community.
Community organisation.
Yeah, it's in 128 countries around the world.
Right, tell us about it.
It was started in 1975 by a group of women prisoners who, in New York, they had their 50th celebration last year because I went to our national gathering. And these women saw there was a revolving system of young men coming in through the prisons. So they started the development of a program that teaches around violence and non-violence, but it's a personal transformation program so that you can draw power towards you and choose non-violent pathways. So it requires, and the good thing about it, it was designed, had to be simple enough that a child could play. So it's actually a bunch of activities that are play-based where you learn around how to interact with people and you learn about yourself. And then the Quakers picked it up, Friends, Society of Friends,
yep.
Because they often find themselves in the non-peaceful settings while they're looking for peace. And they became very active. But it's in Australia, WA, they've got alternatives to violence programs run by prisoners in prison. And because it's also transformation for the community.
Yeah,
it's not
can you describe it for me?
Yeah, okay.
So let's say you're a prisoner, you're in prison, you're there for, say, some violence charges, you're there. And do people kind of volunteer or are they forced to?
No, it's all voluntary.
It's all voluntary. You're not forced to by the courts.
No. It can be court mandated.
Yeah.
But within the prisons, it's not. It's voluntary.
All voluntary.
And there's a paid facilitator through the Western Australian system. In New South Wales, it's in schools, but in WA, it's in prisons. In Victoria, it's in the community. We're a bit, and in New South Wales, it's online as well. So the first activity that you do, which is what we did at the training that I went to in Papua, is you learn people's names.
Excuse me. Did you just mention the word Papua?
I did.
Why would you go to West Papua to train? What's going on here?
I know. I was very lucky to be one of three Australians to go to a training as a participant run in Papua out of Jayapura, which is the capital, in Sentani, which is a town. And this is a slightly different version than we run in Australia. It's run by the West Pacific group of Friends Peace Teams, and it's a trauma-informed program to teach peace and justice. And so...
They're involved in a 60-year struggle for independence.
Mm-hmm.
There are still guerrillas in the mountains. Mm-hmm. There are still people being killed. There are still people being butchered.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you hope to achieve?
So it was a brilliant environment, actually. We had 30 participants.
Mm-hmm.
Of all ages, and the peace team's facilitators were from the Philippines, Indonesia, and Papua.
Right.
And basically they ran 3 days of what we call personal transformation, and you play games, basically. Like, learning name is the first thing. It sounds random, but once you get to know the person and you truly know the name, and we give ourselves affirmation names.
Mm-hmm.
So straight from the get-go, it's seeing you in a positive light and you see yourself in a positive light. And then you do fun activities where you interact with one another and you discover how you work together in groups. And in between all that, because sometimes the work can be heavy, if you're practicing skills in listening and being a good companion and learning how to be a good companion, which is a listener. And sometimes people will share a story of violence that can be strong. So this trauma-informed care workshop allows for discharge. So you learn how to recognise the signs where you were becoming overwhelmed and stand up and jump up and down and shake your body and then you could sit yourself back down and be more centred in your heart and your mind and your spirit.
I'm looking at you disbelievingly, you know that.
Because the
reason, does it work?
Yeah, it's based on a program that I think was developed in conjunction with the Rwandan government,
right?
After their troubles,
yep.
And so it's based on that program.
So who organised this in West Papua?
So it's Friends Peace Teams.
Right.
I'm just making sure I get the organisation name right. So I'm looking up my notes. Cause
that's all right. Yeah.
A West Pacific region.
Right.
It's they have a small amount of funding. And when I say small, like this was self-funded by
So you paid
the participants.
Your own way.
And we pay a little bit extra so that we can fund the locals because we had some young people under the age of 18 there.
Right.
And we had some older people and I think I was up the older end. And then we had a priest.
Not unusual in West Papua, very religious people.
But also he was from an organisation that they were happy for me to share the name, which was the Justice and Peace and Integrity Creations, JPIC.
Right.
They're Franciscan monks and they're mainly there operating in places all over the world that experience oppression and militarism.
Did you have your obligatory Indonesian observer?
Not that I know of.
Not that you know of.
Yeah, not that I know of.
So you weren't considered to be any threat to anybody?
No.
No.
So, correct, I don't believe so. I don't know the inner workings of these things, but, and, you know, we kept a fairly low profile because we were there for 5 days of training, first three being personal transformation where you gain insight into who you are, how you see violence and non-violence, because sometimes if you've been exposed to violence a lot, you don't know there's what non-violence is.
Right.
And then caring for yourself as well as caring for others starts become, and then you recognise your inner strengths. And then you move into 3 days of community transformation where you start to see yourself connected to the people around you. How can you be centred and find non-violent pathways to benefit your community? The activities that we do are experiential. And so you learn about it by doing, not by talking about it. Oh, there's a bit of talking, like talking about privilege and prejudice and oppression, but really you learn by doing, because if you can learn it in a childlike way, it seeps into your soul much more than if you went to a lecture.
I'm not convinced, but I'm just an irritable, grumpy old man. I'm not convinced. Let's come back to the community angle here in Victoria. What do you do in Victoria?
With the Alternative Violence Project?
Yes.
So at the moment we haven't got any active workshops ready to go.
Right.
But we have kind of the system in the AVP world, Alternative Violence world, is there's 3 different types of training.
Yep.
And
What are the 3 different
types? The
first
one is basic training,
right,
which is what I would call that personal transformation, which is I signed up for it because there was a space in my world that felt very conflicted and I was going along to this 2 days of workshop or 3 days of workshop ready to find out how I could fix those people that I was really grumpy at because they were grumpy with me.
Right.
And then by the end of the 3 days, I worked out that it starts with me.
Right.
Because we'd have games and like the Quaker way or the Society of Friends way, you have a game and then you sit and reflect. What's your part in it? What did you learn from it? And then over time, over the 3 days, I discovered, maybe it starts with me.
Right.
And then you can go on and do advanced training. So I did advanced training in 2024. And it was one of the hardest things I've done. And I've done an advanced diploma in facilitation experiential, and that was hard, but there's less leading by the facilitators and more the group leads, because it's not therapy, but it is therapeutic when you walk yourself through challenging situations where you've experienced violence or you've witnessed it. And it doesn't have to be the overt physical violence. It can be micro violence actions or something you've seen in the street or something has happened to you. And we picked conflict as our theme for the weekend.
Right.
So every single activity put you into a conflict situation with people, differences of opinion. But it would set it up so that there would be an activity where you haven't been given all the information, or some of the people when you bring the two groups together have been given a different set of rules to you. We did an activity called labels at our workshop where you had a label stuck on your head and you didn't know what it said, but you could read everybody else's.
Right.
And you were given a job, where are you going to dinner? And it took me a little while to work out that my label was ignored.
Right.
And there's lots of people who have that label that has been given to them. Either they've learnt it through rigid family patterns or... So there's nothing like the experience. So I did advanced, which was, whew, that was intense, 3 days. And then I'm kind of an apprentice around facilitation, but you do training for facilitators, which then enables you to go and run the workshops.
I mean, look, it sounds, you know, useful. Is there any interaction with the infrastructure you're dealing with? We're not just individuals in society. We're part of a society that's got certain rules, certain, you know, cultural norms.
And violence can be perpetrated by a system.
Exactly. So how do you deal with that?
So depending on when it's – certainly when I see peace teams, friends peace teams running, they acknowledge the systems that people are working in.
Right.
When you have a discussion around violence and nonviolence, you have to look at the, you know, the iceberg model where you can see the violence, and then there's all the systemic things around oppression.
Around it. Right.
And often people don't realise how they've experienced oppression because they've just been living in it. And that goes in our culture as well. Like we practiced a game at our monthly peace practice meeting that's in Victoria, and someone had just witnessed some horrible racism with someone yelling at someone who was dressed differently, of two females at a tram stop. And we sat and had a role play around that, which was sounds silly, but when you're really in it, it's hard to – the emotions happen even if you know it's fake, if someone's yelling at you. And so – the role play is set up in a way that you can learn what could you do differently. And I learnt something that I will do. I will be a bystander and a witness, and that changes the power from the oppressor to more towards the people. And that's what I'll do next time I see someone being racially or otherwise slurred at a bus stop.
So if people are interested, say if there's any listeners that are interested in pursuing these ideas, any contact details?
Yeah, you just have to look up on the web.
What do you look up?
Alternatives to Violence.
So
AVP, Alternatives to Violence Project is the full acronym.
AVP Project. Yeah. Any dots anywhere or just AVP Project?
Just Google that. It's worldwide. They'll get so many AVP Project options to choose from.
Well, although I'm sceptical, it must be effective for a lot of people. Otherwise, it wouldn't be worldwide and it wouldn't have lasted 50 years, would
128
it?
Countries.
That's right. Obviously, there is something important going on there, and which people should examine.
And there's different... And the reason it's run in country is then people take that away and then they set up things in their own community that they feel are important to set up, and that's what happens all over the world. People, so in Australia it's in schools because they want to get to young people early, and WA it's in prisons.
Right.
And so to give people a transformative way of interacting with the world that might be different to how that...
Look,
they interacted in the past.
Anything is worth a go in those situations. Otherwise, we just repeat the same mistakes over and over and over again, and people, there's no way out.
And the other organisation was Friends Peace Teams.
So they're kind of associated or different?
Yeah, so they are associated because they implement, they're set up all over the world as well, but they implement Alternatives to Violence Project activities and principles. They just implement them slightly differently, like the West Pacific uses trauma-informed care, just because they're often working in places that aren't peaceful.
That's right. So, you sure you're going to decrease your volunteer activities in 2026? It doesn't seem like it, Shelley, does
it? Didn't start that way, but...
No.
Yes, I am. I'm going to take it. I've got some family things that I need to sort out this year, and I'm... So every time I get excited and want to jump up and do something new, I say, this is the year where you need to just be a bit quieter and focus on some family things.
What you need to do is you need to get that burr out from under the saddle and airbrush it and decide.
Oh, no, that burr stays there with other little burrs.
Does it?
Yeah, Christina Story, our founder. God, sounds like a cult. Who's established it. I wouldn't stop because until we get success.
Now, what do you think is – we've only got about 5 minutes left. So what do you think is the greatest threat today?
Oh, man.
Yeah, men, I agree, yep.
Oh, and there's so many things. I don't know, I was just...
I mean, what would you like to see change?
Yeah, okay, to bring about peace.
Bring about peace. Yeah.
To, I'm really nervous about, I've chosen to withdraw from watching the news and withdrawn from social media and so that because of the discourse that's occurring in our world, and I'm not going to talk about politics or name people because right. I think it feeds the
black
beast.
Wolf. Yeah.
And so that it's that the discourse that's occurring, which is pushing people in directions that disconnect them rather than connect them, because with disconnection becomes instability.
Well, people think they're independent thinkers when they're on the on virtual platforms. The fact is they've been pushed and prodded by algorithms.
Algorithms, yeah. And you know, I had a discussion with someone today who's having a bit of time out from Instagram because they had been hovering over, not clicking, but hovering over, and some of the views and the barrage of destructive content that was being thrown at them, especially young men nowadays. So
anything to advertise
to get a click,
get advertising, get eyeballs on it, charge them more. Doesn't matter what it is, how destructive it is, individually, society-wise.
Yeah, it's just separating people.
It's just extraordinary. It really is. I mean, in 1 minute, you know, one click, you can, you know, destroy the universe. It's extraordinary. How are you going to, when are you going to fully retire from paid work, do you think?
I don't know. My husband's got a countdown clock.
A countdown clock.
Yeah.
Is this like the, 1 minute to midnight, the atomic?
Yeah, so he's got his countdown clock going for when retirement will occur.
How about you?
Yeah, we'll, see how it goes.
You'll be very busy, you know that. More busy than you are now. I suggest you continue working at least that you can rest during that period.
Yes. So he's got a countdown clock, so we want to do more touring and travelling, and although I get to go overseas. A lot. We're going overseas next month, going songwriting retreats. So I can't complain. I get to travel.
You're doing a songwriting retreat overseas?
Yeah, in Vietnam.
I thought you'd put up a tent in the backyard.
No.
Vietnam.
Yeah, my friend Jane Corns runs them. When you get captured, capture yourself and go into retreat where you've got no other distractions other than where will I have my next coffee or what to eat for lunch, you come with a song a day.
Oh.
And it's a great way to songwrite.
Well, that's why you need to work.
You've
got to pay for it.
That's right.
Activists don't seem to understand this. You need income. Look, I'm 74 and I still work part-time for that very reason.
I think to fund
my picadillos, as they say.
I was looking at some stats of workforce stats for occupational therapists, and I think I'm in the 3% range.
3% range. Yeah,
of OTs working at my age. They're probably all in management, and I've been in management, but I came out of management. I needed to.
Well, in medicine, it's the other way around. There's so many elderly doctors around that they're thinking of doing exam. We already do, keep up to date with stuff, but actually do physical examinations of everybody over 75 who's practicing medicine.
Mm.
So that could be happening to you.
Yes.
They may get you to weave baskets, and if you can't weave it, they'll take away your license.
Never.
Now, Shelley, it's been a great pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
I've learned a lot of things. I may be sceptical, but that's my role. And I'm hoping, I'm really hoping that Henrietta will podcast this, we'll take a photograph of you, we'll podcast this, and that people will actually look at that contact points you suggested, because anything is worthwhile in terms of trying to reduce interpersonal violence and violence within communities, because nobody wins at the end of the day.
Nope.
Nobody wins. So what's that contact point again?
The two's Alternatives to Violence Project, and the second one was Friends Peace Teams.
For Friends Peace Team. Thank you very much.
Oh, and you forgot my Sydney Road is Accessible Tram Stops group.
What is it called?
Sydney Roads Accessible Tram
Stops.
But
that's only for people who live in Brunswick.
Oh.
Well, why would I care about Sydney?
No, we're fighting for rights of disabilities and people.
Oh, yeah, bloody Brunswick people. It's like Castlemaine, North Northcote, who knows. Henrietta, thank you very much for putting up with us. And what are you going to do? You're still waiting. She's waiting for Goddard.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.
3CR is one of a kind. We have 400 volunteers and cover an incredible array of programming content.
From special broadcast events on Invasion Day or Trans Day of Visibility to any of our 120 weekly shows, 3CR has got your radical radio listening covered.
Subscribe to 3CR at 3cr.org.au and support independent, community-owned media, free of commercial influence and government bias.
Help to keep 3CR unique by becoming a subscriber today.
And now that heart is beating fast, and that's the rhythm I can dance to. I'm mighty glad I've got a chance to. That one big...